So in 2000 and, in February 2008, Finnish artist Pilvi Takala conducted a month-long intervention at the global accounting company Deloitte. And to the people at the office, she was introduced as Johanna Takala, a trainee, as you noticed, and a master degree student who was working on her thesis. The first 2.5 weeks went by without any remarkable event. She did what the trainee was expected to do, such as took photocopies or worked on her laptop. Then she stopped all physical activities, as you noticed, that would indicate that she was working. So she spent her days sitting at her desk or at the elevator. And when she was asked what she was doing, she would explain rather ambiguously that she was thinking and doing brain work. And also, this caused a lot of turmoil in the office. So people were really disturbed by this. They sent these emails and whatever. So throughout her intervention, Takala documented these events with hidden cameras, as well as collected emails and voicemails that were sent concerning her actions. Based on the material, she compiled the piece called The Trainee, which is actually it's an installation piece, that this video is just part of it. So the reason why I want to start with Takala's work when approaching the theme of this symposium is that for me, the trainee offers an interesting entryway to art's relation to political and possibly revolutionary practice within contemporary capitalism. It has been read both as a radical Bartleby-like gesture aligned with the Occupy movement, as well as a productive training method for Deloitte's workers, which is actually Deloitte's part. Deloitte was actually, they funded this whole piece. So without going too deep in the debate how to label Takala's intervention, that is, was it truly political or not, I'm interested in examining what does Takala's ambiguous passivity bringing to the task of rethinking revolution, its event, and its aesthetics. And here, when I'm talking about event, I'm not going to Badiou. This is just a way to think the very event, the duration of politics and revolution. So the title of my talk, Corrosive Temporalities, Art in the Time of Revolution, is based on the following reading of the trainee. Rather than producing herself as a political subject who counters the existing order, but this as a kind of like antagonist subject, or revolutionary subject, Johanna Takala takes up a corrosive relation to this order, and most importantly, to herself. So what do I mean by this corrosiveness? By neither fully affirming nor negating her given subject position as a trainee, she produces ambiguity that puts the very order where she appears in question, at least momentarily. So in other words, she constitutes an oxymoronic relation between what she produces, so she produces her appearance as a trainee, and also as an artist, she produces her appearance, and what she conceals, so the disappearance of that trainee, or her secret, that she is in fact an artist. So as visible from the trainee, this ambiguity has a lot to do with duration, and that is time. For example, when she spent the entire day in an elevator, it is her durative presence, not simply an appearance, like, hey, I'm a subject, I appear like this, that shocks the people at the office and makes her so unnerving. Understand this durative ambiguity as corrosive, because it puts the relation between production and its outcomes in question. In temporal terms, this ambiguity corrodes a future that we might see ahead of us. So, before going into details of what do I mean by this, I think it's important to step back a bit and contextualize my take on aesthetics and revolutionary politics. Here I will not take time to reflect the whole the historical connections about this topic. So I'm only interested in examining how could we use art as a tool to approach the concept of revolution and its temporal arrangements. So, if we Google revolutionary art, and of Googling is, nowadays like the kind of whatever, what people think or whatever, the common opinion, this is what probably we get. So, indeed, it is fairly safe to claim that revolutionary art often engenders this kind of imaginary in our minds, as you know, the kind of political art style. We usually see pictures of depicting what's currently wrong in the society, representations of revolutionary actions, or struggles, or images of the future after the event of revolution. Here, a revolutionary image comes close to what Walter Benjamin warned us about the aestheticization of politics, even though the task of communism was, of course, the politicization of art and aesthetics. So this means that revolutionary practice of the artist is reduced simply to represent the revolution, and of course, as you can see from here, it's also usually embodied in these revolutionary leaders, which is, I think, one of the problems why we have to kind of rethink revolutionary art. So of course, we should also make a distinction between art that simply represents a revolution and revolutionary aesthetics, which brings us to contested terrain of the avant-garde. After all, the aesthetic avant-garde, as revolutionary aesthetics, was and or still is not about representing the world, but changing it by changing conditions of possibility for an aesthetic appearance. As it is well known, this call for creating disruptive aesthetic appearances was taken up by multiple, also conflicting political programs throughout the 20th century, Italian Futurism being one of them, I think, good example. So, here, let me just say what I find possibly troublesome about these two strategies that I've just quickly glanced. That is, when art becomes easily understood as a way to give form to the anticipation of revolution. That is, it either depicts revolution as a new day or as a struggle, or anticipates in its very practice. So, in avant-garde as a kind of some people who are ahead of their time, right? So, and also these kind of anticipations usually represented in activity, right? So there's activity. So temporal arrangement of revolution is then tied to a chronological relation between the past, the present, and the future, which in turn makes revolution itself appear as a cut or a break devoid of duration, something that we can take a picture of revolution and that's it. So going back to the trainee, what I find interesting about Johanna Takala's durative presence is that she does not offer any kind of anticipation of change, but on the contrary, presents a time that seems to have ceased. By repeatedly claiming that she is indeed working, she performs a horrifying continuity of the present without a clear end. So here, the comparison between the trainee and Occupy movement does make sense. Its presence as such, not a clearly articulated program, that matters. However, while in Occupy Wall Street, this presence took the form of swarming activity, and we can think of like the human speaker, snappy signs, and drum circles, and whatever. Johanna Takala's ambiguous presence is immersed in strange passivity. That, unlike Bartleby's, I prefer not to, actually takes part in the function of the office by performing the immaterialness of her labor. So it is within this context that we have to go back to my initial claims about corrosive temporality of Johanna Takala and see how could it be elaborated as an aesthetic concept when rethinking revolution. Indeed, if we reject the anticipatory traits of revolutionary art, we are left with an event of revolution that does not follow a chronological time, an empty time in Benjaminian sense, but would possibly question the conditions to think chronologically. So what we have here is what we could call the unknown of revolution. I think this is, you know, the novelty or originality that we talked earlier, or the not yet of revolution. That is the otherness of a future that the revolution brings. It is important to acknowledge, however, the danger of romanticizing this unknown, especially when connected to the supposed open-endedness of art. You know, the trite idea that artists can do whatever, you know, they're so, you know, they never really know what they're doing. So I'm not trying to do that here. We do live in an era where ambiguity has become a rule, right? As workers, we are subjected to neoliberal flexibility that demands abilities to mold ourselves according to the changing landscape of speculative capital. And again, this is the Deloitte side of the story. In this respect, I'm not arguing for a mere replacement of chronological linearity with an unknown future. On the contrary, I think we need to resist the obsessive gaze that the speculative capital lays upon the unknown. That is, the unknown as an infinite promise that can be harnessed in the speculation itself. We can think of, like, you know, insurance, for example. An approach is unknown, as an impasse of thought that puts not only the future, but the present as well in question. So here we could go to Jacques Rancière and his concept of redistribution of the sensible as the revolutionary moment of change that does not allow itself to be anticipated or planned. The problem with Rancière is, however, that his writings do not really offer us tools to think the duration of revolutionary event. Not at least explicitly. I've tried to do that, but it's very, very difficult. That is to grasp the eventness of change that the redistribution of the sensible introduces to the reality. So this is why I'd rather go, and this is kind of like my project right now, is to go to the writings of Maurice Blanchot, a corrosive writer par excellence. So what especially intrigues me in Blanchot is that his writing itself presents an endless deferral of totality, a space of literature, as he calls it, that turns back to itself not in order to affirm its power, but to undo it. So I'm just going to quote him, what he writes about writing. So writing begins only when it is the approach to that point where nothing reveals itself, where at the heart of dissimulation, speaking is still but the shadow of speech, a language which is still only its image, an imaginary language and a language of the imaginary, the one nobody speaks, the murmur of the incessant and interminable, which one has to silence if one wants at last to be heard. So this paradoxical relationship between speech and silence points to the very poiesis of art without reducing it to the artist or to the artwork. This means that the temporality of writing or art making in general, and I would also claim politics here, this is what I'm trying to do, is a temporality without a clear origin or an end, and a temporality of an appearance beyond a fixed presence. It denotes, as Blanchot claims, a non-dialectical time, a time of time's absence. And in this time, he writes, what appears is the fact that nothing appears. What appears is the being deep within being's absence, which is when there is nothing, and which, as soon as there is something, is no longer. So, end quote. So, going back to Johanna Takala's ambiguous presence at Deloitte, it is this intensification of time that is her derivative presence, the affirmation of the now, and the non-linearity of this time that is that she affirms the present to the point that corrodes the future, that, read through Blanchot, opens up an aesthetics of a political, perhaps, appearance that is not merely about affirming or anticipating a world to come, that is kind of like some sort of completion of a political action or event, presents itself as the murmur of the incessant and interminable, that indeed people at the office tried to silence. So they tried to silence her silence in a really weird way. So the rethink revolution from this perspective means then that the anticipation of its emergence turns into a time of waiting during which time itself is put to task. As Blanchot writes in Awaiting Oblivion, Latin l'oubli, his book dedicated to the theme of waiting, remembering, forgetting, and I quote, "Waiting is when time is always in excess, and when time is nevertheless short on time. This overabundant lack of time is the duration of waiting," end quote. This elusive character of Blanchotian waiting is, I believe, something that we can see operating in The Trainee. By involving her colleagues in a tedious time of waiting without a clear end, you know, she's always in the elevator. Johanna Takala corrodes the precarious temporality of cognitive capital by affirming both its excess and its lack. Here, the possibility, possibly revolutionary force of Takala's ambiguity does not stem from negation, right? But from a destructive double affirmation, and double affirmation is a key thing for Blanchot. So, yes, I'm working, and yes, I'm doing nothing, right? So she's saying both. So to conclude, my attempt has been to discuss how contemporary art, specifically the trainee, could contribute to the task of rethinking revolution and its aesthetics. I do acknowledge that there are problems with this kind of passivity that the trainee represents. After all, Takala's passivity stems from a position of privilege, and it's also institutionally governed. Again, it was commissioned by Viasma, the Museum of Contemporary Art, and funded by Deloitte. Thus, I'm not claiming that this work would be an example of new kind of revolutionary action, but I hope that it helps to open up the discussion about the intricacies of time and its passing on theorizing and why not practicing revolution. Certainly, to rethink revolution through this frame puts its grandiose legacy in question and unfolds inherently precarious time of change. This, I claim, is the challenge of today's revolutionary thought, when the scale and time of revolution are without a transcendental justification or universal frame, that is, as a historical necessity or total mobilization, it becomes a set of precarious gestures that reflect the unnerving uncertainty embedded in contemporary capital. So, following the words of Giorgio Agamben, that of the original task of a genuine revolution is never merely to change the world, but also, and above all, to change time, I believe that it is this uncertainty that we must tackle and inhabit when imagining the possible temporalities of revolution. I'm almost finished. Art, in this case, and connecting to our earlier discussion about these geniuses, art in this case could offer some hints that what would this look like in practice, or at least help us to imagine these possibilities. So that's it.